Modern people think the fundamental issue is, do you believe in God? But that's not the fundamental issue. The fundamental issue is, what do you mean by God? And so let me give you an example of this that will make it clearer. So there's a medieval idea that God is the summum bonum, which means the sum of all that's good, or the essence of all that's good. Okay, you might say, well, I don't believe in that. Now remember, this is the definition of God, right? God is the sum of all that's good. Okay, all right, so you don't believe in that. All right, let's take that apart. Do you believe that some things are better than other things? Well, people will say yes. Okay, so then you believe that there is a scale of good. Okay, is there something that all things that are good share in common? And the answer to that has to be yes, because otherwise you don't have a conception of good, right? The word good implies that across good things, there's some essence. Okay, well, the definition, one medieval definition of God is the essence of good. Well, okay, let's say you don't believe in that. Okay, does that mean you don't believe in anything that's good? Okay, then how do you act then? Because to act means to do something that's better than what you're doing now, right? There's no action without movement towards the good. And while you might say, well, I don't believe that there's a unitary good. Okay, you believe there's a fractionated good. Well, then what do you do when those things oppose one another, right? Which would be in a conflict of duty. What do you refer to help you adjudicate between different goods? Well, generally what you do is, if you could pursue A, which is good, or B, which is good, and they conflict, then you pick the higher good. Okay, do you believe in a higher good? Well, if you don't, you can't decide between goods, which means you're paralyzed. If you do believe in the higher good, then do you believe in the highest good? Well, the highest good is God. What do you mean by that? By definition. Okay, so now you have a definition. Now, then the next question might be, well, what's your relationship with the highest good? And you might say, well, I don't have a relationship. It's like, well, actually you do, because you act in relationship to it. You can't help it. One of the interesting things about the biblical corpus is that it's based on the insistence that you have a relationship with being and becoming, a relationship, like a personal relationship.
The biblical narrative of paradise and the fall provides a profound account of the nature of being and points the way to a mode of conceptualization and action well matched to that nature. In the Garden of Eden, prior to the dawn of self-consciousness, so goes the story. Human beings were sinless. Our primordial parents, Adam and Eve, walked with God. Then, tempted by the snake, the first couple ate from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, discovered death and vulnerability, and turned away from God. Mankind was exiled from paradise and began its effortful mortal existence. The idea of sacrifice enters soon afterward, beginning with the account of Cain and Abel, and developing through the Abrahamic adventures and the Exodus. After much contemplation, struggling humanity learns that God's favor could be gained and his wrath averted through proper sacrifice, and also that bloody murder might be motivated among those unwilling or unable to succeed in this manner. When engaging in sacrifice, our forefathers began to act out what would be considered a proposition, if it were stated in words, that something better might be attained in the future by giving up something of value in the present. The necessity for work is one of the curses placed by God upon Adam and his descendants in consequence of original sin. Adam's waking to the fundamental constraints of his being, his vulnerability, his eventual death, is equivalent to his discovery of the future. The future. That's where you go to die. Hopefully not too soon. Your demise might be staved off through work, through the sacrifice of the now to gain benefit later. It is for this reason, among others no doubt, that the concept of sacrifice is introduced in the biblical chapter immediately following the drama of the fall. There is little difference between sacrifice and work. They are also both uniquely human. Sometimes animals act as if they are working, but they are really only following the dictates of their nature. Beavers build dams. They do so because they are beavers, and beavers build dams. They don't think, yeah, but I'd rather be on a beach in Mexico with my girlfriend while they're doing it. Prosaically, such sacrifice, work, is delay of gratification. But that's a very mundane phrase to describe something of such profound significance. The discovery that gratification could be delayed was simultaneously the discovery of time and, with it, causality, at least the causal force of voluntary human action. Long ago, in the dim mists of time, we began to realize that reality was structured as if it could be bargained with. We learned that behaving properly now, in the present, regulating our impulses, considering the plight of others, could bring rewards in the future, in a time and place that did not yet exist. We began to inhibit, control, and organize our immediate impulses so that we could stop interfering with other people and our future selves. Doing so was indistinguishable from organizing society. The discovery of the causal relationship between our efforts today and the quality of tomorrow motivated the social contract, the organization that enables today's work to be stored, reliably, mostly in the form of promises from others. Understanding is often acted out before it can be articulated, just as a child acts out what it means to be mother or father before being able to give a spoken account of what those roles mean. The act of making a ritual sacrifice to God was an early and sophisticated enactment of the idea of the usefulness of delay. There is a long conceptual journey between merely feasting hungrily and learning to set aside some extra meat, smoked by the fire, for the end of the day, or for someone who isn't present. It takes a long time to learn to keep anything later for yourself, or to share it with someone else. And those are very much the same thing as, in the former case, you are sharing with your future self. It is much easier and far more likely to selfishly and immediately wolf down everything in sight. There are similar long journeys between every leap in sophistication with regard to delay and its conceptualization. Short-term sharing, storing away for the future, representation of that storage in the form of records, and later in the form of currency, and ultimately, the saving of money in a bank or other social institution. Some conceptualizations had to serve as intermediaries, or the full range of our practices and ideas surrounding sacrifice and work and their representation could have never emerged. Our ancestors acted out a drama, a fiction. They personified the force that governs fate as a spirit that can be bargained with, traded with as if it were another human being. And the amazing thing is that it worked. This was in part because the future is largely composed of other human beings, often precisely those who have watched and evaluated and appraised the tiniest details of your past behavior. It's not very far from that to God, sitting above on high, tracking your every move and writing it down for further reference in a big book. Here's a productive symbolic idea. The future is a judgmental father. That's a good start. But two additional archetypal foundational questions arose because of the discovery of sacrifice, of work. Both have to do with the ultimate extension of the logic of work, which is sacrifice now to gain later. First question. What must be sacrificed? Small sacrifices may be sufficient to solve small, singular problems. But it is possible that larger, more comprehensive sacrifices might solve an array of large and complex problems all at the same time. That's harder, but it might be better. Adapting to the necessary discipline of medical school will, for example, fatally interfere with the licentious lifestyle of a hardcore undergraduate party animal. Giving that up is a sacrifice. But a physician can, to paraphrase George W., really put food on his family. That's a lot of trouble dispensed with over a very long period of time. So sacrifices are necessary to improve the future, and larger sacrifices can be better. Second question, set of related questions, really. We've already established the basic principle, sacrifice will improve the future. But a principle, once established, has to be fleshed out. Its full extension or significance has to be understood. What is implied by the idea that sacrifice will improve the future? In the most extreme and final of cases. Where does that basic principle find its limits? We must ask, to begin, what would be the largest, most effective, most pleasing of all possible sacrifices? And then how good might the best possible future be if the most effective sacrifice could be made? The God of Western tradition, like so many gods, requires sacrifice. But sometimes he goes even further. He demands not only sacrifice, but the sacrifice of precisely what is loved best. This is most starkly portrayed, and most confusingly evident, in the story of Abraham and Isaac. Abraham, beloved of God, long wanted a son, and God promised him exactly that, after many delays, and under the apparently impossible conditions of old age and a long barren wife. But not so long afterward, when the miraculously born Isaac is still a child, God turns around and in unreasonable and apparently barbaric fashion demands that his faithful servant offer his son as a sacrifice. The story ends happily. God sends an angel to stay Abraham's obedient hand and accepts a ram in Isaac's stead. That's a good thing, but it doesn't really address the issue at hand. Why is God's going further necessary? Why does life impose such demands? We'll start our analysis with a truism, stark, self-evident, and understated. Sometimes things do not go well. That seems to have much to do with the terrible nature of the world, with its plagues and famines and tyrannies and betrayals. But here's the rub. Sometimes when things are not going well, it's not the world that's the cause. The cause is instead that which is currently most valued subjectively and personally. Why? Because the world is revealed to an indeterminate degree through the template of your values. If the world you are seeing is not the world you want, therefore, it's time to examine your values. It's time to rid yourself of your current presuppositions. It's time to let go. It might even be time to sacrifice what you love best so that you can become who you might become instead of staying who you are.
The more radical the necessary change, the more pain that accompanies it. Like the more opportunity as well. And a lot of what we learn painfully. And so it's not surprising that people shrink away from learning. We learn in pain and anxiety very frequently. Everyone knows that. Like the things that you really learned in life, it's like, it was no joy, man. Like it took you out. And so the fact that people flee from that is hardly surprising. But it doesn't help. That's the thing. It just stores up the catastrophe for later. And so the better idea is to eat a little poison every day so that you don't have to overdose in a month. It's something like that. And it is the case that I think because you don't learn unless you're forced to learn. I know there's alternatives to that. There's the voluntary search for knowledge, and that's a fine thing, and that is an antidote to this. But apart from that, speaking more practically, you tend not to learn unless you're forced to learn, and what you tend to learn by force are difficult lessons. And so people are very prone to not seek that out. It's not surprising, but it's because they don't understand the consequences very well. You know, it's because they're convinced that there's some way of forestalling the necessary learning, and there isn't any way of forestalling it. All you do is make it worse in the future. You make yourself smaller and you make the lesson harder. And so that's why in so many religious doctrines there's emphasis on humility. You know, and humility isn't to debase yourself. It's to understand that you don't know enough so that your life isn't going to be miserable. And so every chance you get to grab something new that will help you along your way, you should take it as fast as you can. But you have to have a very tragic, I would say, view of reality, and also a harsh one, because it's not just tragedy, it's also malevolence. You have to understand that those are waiting for you, and that makes you desperate enough to learn. And that might be make you desperate enough to fall out of your ideology. But that's a hard way of looking at the world. It beats living through it, though.
Aim up. Pay attention. Fix what you can fix. Don't be arrogant in your knowledge. Strive for humility, because totalitarian pride manifests itself in intolerance, oppression, torture, and death. Become aware of your own insufficiency, your cowardice, malevolence, resentment, and hatred. Consider the murderousness of your own spirit before you dare accuse others, and before you attempt to repair the fabric of the world. Maybe it's not the world that's at fault. Maybe it's you. You've failed to make the mark. You've missed the target. You've fallen short of the glory of God. You've sinned. And all of that is your contribution to the insufficiency and evil of the world. And above all, don't lie. Don't lie about anything ever. Lying leads to hell. It was the great and the small lies of the Nazi and communist states that produced the deaths of millions of people. Consider then that the alleviation of unnecessary pain and suffering is a good. Make that an axiom. To the best of my ability, I will act in a manner that leads to the alleviation of unnecessary pain and suffering. You have now placed at the pinnacle of your moral hierarchy a set of presuppositions and actions aimed at the betterment of being. Why? Because we know the alternative. The alternative was the 20th century. The alternative was so close to hell that the difference is not worth discussing. And the opposite of hell is heaven. To place the alleviation of unnecessary pain and suffering at the pinnacle of your hierarchy of value is to work to bring about the kingdom of God on earth. That's a state, and a state of mind at the same time.